Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Ali Shariat is an Iranian-born lawyer practicing in Auckland. He has been keeping an anxious eye on developments in Iran through the unprecedented information available from both citizen and mainstream media sources. He joins us now. So Ali, how are you getting your information at the moment?
By and large, most of my information comes from the internet. I often find that, you know, lots of mainstream media can be a bit behind, but mainly through forms like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, but also what might be considered maybe more traditional as well, you know, the internet, newspapers, so The Guardian, The Independent, and things like that.
When using these new media like the micro-blogging site Twitter or YouTube or blogs, how do you go about making sure that the information is credible?
That's probably one of the most difficult things. So I spend a lot of time reading as much as I can, and from there, with a bit of background knowledge, I guess makes it a bit easier, kind of discern what's not quite so accurate, what's kind of trying to hype people up, and background like that. Also, it kind of balance that against comments from family at home, or if I've called people in Iran and try and see where it fits in with that.
Do you think there's deliberate misinformation being put out there using those same sites?
Yeah, there's definitely a risk of that. I mean, even if you read them, you'll hear people saying, you know, watch out for this certain user because they're a government agent, or people saying the opposite, this person's spreading misinformation and lies. And obviously, in terms of the Iranian government, it's a perfect tactic for them to try and spread protesters out or get some misinformation out there.
There's obviously been attempts to shut down a lot of the the news coming out of Iran. They've obviously certain correspondents have been unable to report or have been kicked out. Generally speaking, is there a live and well blogging scene in Iran prior to this?
I think Iran, I don't know the exact figures, but would probably have one of the largest per capita, at least, number of bloggers in the world. Even people from within the regime and the leadership, or even conservative clergy people, have their own blogs, and they're very well, educated, these people as well. So everyone's up there.
There's a huge, hugely young population there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, about 30% of the population is under the age of 30. So all these people have been born after the revolution, and they want to know what's going on in the world, and they also want the world to know what's going on in their world. So a lot of people are on the internet, just getting their views out, getting their photos and opinions out. So a lot of the youth use it as a tool, conservative and liberal.
And when you're looking at things like, a lot has been made of the way that Twitter really rose to the occasion when mainstream media weren't able to report, and the government had actually closed down blogs that were happening up to the election, didn't they? What has Twitter been for you in the coverage?
For me personally, Twitter has been useful for getting who I haven't maybe within Iran. See, that's one of the problems, you don't know who's actually there. So it's been useful to get an idea of what's going on the street and what they're planning, but at the same time it's very risky because you don't know who to believe. Obviously a lot of people heard of Persian Kiwi, and at the beginning I don't know how credible he is now. But at the beginning, he was definitely a very credible source.
Do you think Twitter's inherent limitations, 140 characters, does that create issues in terms of the actual detail that's getting out there?
Yeah, exactly. That makes it very hard. And often, if you're a novice, you may not understand what RT means, or you see these hash tags in there, so you may not know what that means. It does allow you to have little hyperlinks to larger, things or articles or clips, but there is a bit of a limit to really get expression out there.
Prior to this uprising, the protests that we've seen, I mean, there was a lot of talk just as we were heading into the elections of what an alive democracy Iran is, and isn't that great that it's, that they are holding free and open elections. Has this proven that to be a complete, that sort of thought to be a complete farce, do you think?
Not really, because I think even with, because I even did some, I looked into this a bit as well, and I think Iran was playing a democratic game, and there was a bit of a democratic culture developing, and there was also the first public live debate, where most interestingly for me anyway was that two leaders from within the regime kind of broke ranks and started criticizing each other and openly doing this, and you know, even openly saying someone is corrupt when the other person's corrupt. So
you can have all the debates you want if the results still decided before the election, can't you, though?
Exactly, and that's the problem.
Is the fact that these protests have occurred after the election actually a sign that perhaps democracy has got some groundswell there now?
Definitely. The right to vote is a luxury that Iranians, you know, it's probably one of their most special luxuries. So they don't have that many political rights, and the ability to vote is so special. And so once that was taken away and that democratic culture had been kind of established, people were like, no, hey, that's enough. We want our vote, and we're going to go and try and fight for it. And they took to the streets.
Has that ferocity of the protests and the government response, did that catch you by surprise?
No, because I think there was a lot of discontent before the elections. A lot of people didn't like Ahmadinejad. Although he did have a lot of support, there were still a lot of people who didn't like him. And once the votes were brought in, or the votes, supposed votes were brought in, I think kind of three things kind of went wrong. Firstly, they were greatly exaggerated, so people found that very hard to believe. Two, he was very condescending in his acceptance of it, and he, you know, called a lot of people liars and said lots of bad things. And also, people, you know, like I said, a vote is such a special luxury, so to have that taken away was a really big insult. So these three things together brought everyone to the streets demanding electoral justice, because, you know, that's just the one of the few ways we can reform things.
Now, how do you think, what do you think of the way that outside media have covered this? Do you think that there's some examples of people reading kind of Western liberal interpretations of what's happening? Because this is still a race from two quite fundamental people, isn't it?
Yeah, see, at the moment it's very hard to understand where Mousavi is coming from, who's the liberal leader. But, you know, we have the kind of a saying where, you know, all these leaders are drawn from the same well, all these people from the same thing. So it's quite easy to assume that, you know, it's kind of like Star Wars, is the black and the white, and it's really clear, good and evil. But it isn't quite like that, because, you know, it was under Mousavi that the fact that Iranian women have to wear dark headscarves and chador, he brought that in, and that was when he was president. And now that we see footage of his wife wearing colourful stuff, whether that really means his opinions have changed, or whether that's just a political ploy to
he's not the sort of democratic saviour, the Obama, if you will, of Iran.
No, well, his campaign speeches kind of hint to that, but, you know, these are things that Iranians have heard before. We often have like this very sceptical view of our leaders, especially after the revolution. So, you know, we basically just choose from bad and badder, as we kind of say. So
I think
we choose the bad guy.
You could argue that many countries do the same thing. Is the fact that there's been so much on Twitter and you know, amateur video and these sorts of things, does that indicate that one of the major lines between the establishment and Mousavi is an age thing, that a lot of people pushing for change or pushing for Mousavi are younger people?
That's right, yeah, because I think Iranians, especially the youth, are very disenfranchised. You know, they grew up after the revolution, and a lot of them during the war, and they can, you know, one of their first memories are the war and seeing their neighbours coming back dead or torn apart. So they want something different, and they can see all the stuff going on outside and all these lost opportunities, all this stuff that's going on that they can't quite enjoy, like the ability to just simply travel. You know, we in New Zealand, we go on an OE, but in Iran, to get a passport, firstly, if you're a male, you have to do 2 years military service to get a passport, and then you have to somehow fluke a kind of visa to be able to just simply travel, even if you want to go back to Iran. So the youth really want change, and I definitely say the use of Twitter and Facebook are good indicator of that.
Just finally, are you optimistic that this situation will resolve itself in the coming days or weeks without too much more bloodshed?
Really uncertain on that. It could really go either way. It really depends on what Mousavi does. If he pushes further for more change and the people follow him, so if he actually gets strikes going and mass strikes around the nation, that will be an indicator that things will change in the future. But without a doubt, there will definitely be more bloodshed.
I wish we could end on a happier note. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in, for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Ali Shariat. Coming up after the break, we visit Australia's Yarra Valley and talk to the director of the new Kiwi film, The Strength of Water.